The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your fortnightly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for joining us. My name is Charles Christian, and you're listening to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show. And we start with a bit of news. It's about a cave in the UK area of Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire. It's on the borders there. It's called Creswell Crags. It's a limestone gorge, and it's recently been discovered that there are not dozens, but hundreds of symbols used to ward off the evil eye and misfortune. And it's the largest ever collection of these found in the UK, all in one place. Experts believe they were intended as protection against witches and curses. And Paul Baker, who's the director of the Creswell Heritage Trust, said the marks had been in plain sight and people knew they were there, but we'd been told they were Victorian graffiti. We had no idea of their original origins. They were spotted by a couple of cavers and alerted experts on the subject, including Alison Fern, who's at Leicester University, and she's an expert on protective marks of this nature. They take the form of overlapping V's, referring to the Virgin Mary, and there are also PMs, as in Pace Maria, once again referring to the Virgin Mary, crossed eyes, which is basically Jesus on the cross, and a number of odd-shaped A's, which so far, nobody's actually given an explanation for what they're there for. Alison Fern says they date from the 16th to 19th century, and although they are in Christian in origin, it's not necessarily linked with religion. She says it's the equivalent today of crossing your fingers or saying, oh my God, rather than it actually being a specific invocation to a deity. She adds what the marks were intended to keep out or keep in can only be speculated on. It could be fairies, it could be witches, whatever you were fearful, what was going on down in those caves. Another interesting little element is that the village of Creswell originally was much closer to the caves, these being medieval and late medieval through to 19th century markings. However, in the mid-19th century, the Dukes of Portland, who owned the area, relocated the village 20 minutes walk away. So it makes sense that these were from way back then. And of course, as we all know about caves and the like, they were for many years regarded as a place where supernatural, untamed, non-human forces might live. And indeed, it's noticeable that Creswell Crags has so the distinction of being the first location in the UK where Ice Age cave art, including pictures of birds and deer, bisons and horses, has ever been discovered. That was only 15 years ago they were discovered. So, Creswell Crags, gateway to hell or some kind of place to prevent evil seeping out into the world? On with the show. And here's Janie, who's got a couple of stories for us. One's about a miraculous cure and one's about a ghostly haunting.
Yes, healing waters.
Ooh.
Yes, we have them in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Scotland, we have Loch Monar, and it's a legend. Apparently, on the first Mondays of February May, August and November. If you enter on these certain days of the year, the waters of this loch, chilly, obviously, would heal the sick on the proviso that the loch was entered three times at midnight, even chillier, obviously, and the water then sipped, disgusting, before a silver coin was thrown in. Ah, now we're getting to it, yeah. The sick would then have to leave the site before the sun came up, presumably, and before they started to throw up, having
drunk the water.
Drunk the mucky water.
It seems a bit, if you're sick, it seems quite a lot to get yourself up to a loch at midnight, climb in and out of it three times, and then stagger off.
Kill or cure.
Well, obviously. Yes.
Then we're down in Norfolk.
Oh.
North Reps.
North Reps.
That's kind of North Norfolk.
It is.
Where it's all quite weird. Shrieking Pit is the name of the water. And it's along a lane off of Hungry Hill, just to get the atmosphere right. Now, it happens on the 4th of February, 24th of February. I was getting a bit overexcited. Some do say that the entity that appears in the pit is the spirit of a woman who took her life, while others believe it's something much darker that lures the unwary to their deaths. Nearby North Reps, which is just south of the wonderfully named Hungry Hill, as I just mentioned, is a track which leads to several tree-shrouded and water-filled hollows, which bear the name of the Shrieking Pits. And it's named after a wailing woman whose change of heart after a suicide attempt fell on deaf ears. So, this is what happened. It said, at about midnight on February the 24th, the spirit of a village girl named Esmeralda appears between the veil of the living and the dead. That's all terribly sad. At the age of 17, Esmeralda had fallen in love with a wealthy but untrustworthy young farmer, who conducted a secret relationship with her behind his wife's back. Double boo. The local vicar discovered the affair and ordered them to draw it to a close. So the farmer skulked back to his wife and, without a word from her sweetheart, poor Esmeralda's heart broke. She drifted into misery and depression and was unable to forget her love. So, on a frosty February night, she was wandering the lanes close to the village when she came upon the pit. And in a moment of desperation, she threw herself in. Almost immediately, she regretted a hasty decision and called for help. But none came, and she perished. Her desperate screams can still be heard on February the 24th, adding an extra chill to a winter's night. The pits, in case you were wondering, are believed to be early medieval in origin and created by digging for iron ore to be used in smelting. So that's what they were for. So they're probably quite deep. But yes, poor lady. Now, you see, she'd go on Facebook, wouldn't she?
She would.
And she'd go, do you know what that low-life piece of rubbish has done to me? And everybody would say, kick him to the curb.
Yep.
He's not worth it.
Yep.
Dump his arse. Sorry, can I say that?
Yes.
Okay.
You just have.
Yeah.
And go on daytime TV.
Yeah.
And she'd probably end up getting on a reality TV show.
Possibly.
Be on
Which
Love
would have
Island.
Been a lot better than sinking to the bottom of a freezing pit.
Exactly.
Yes, but they didn't have it then, so there we are. So that's all I have on waters healing and not so healing.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, well, I'm here in what looks to be almost a museum devoted to the Roman age and the Beatles, to talk to John West, who is a fellow presenter on Smart Radio, and he writes about supernatural, and he's also produced a ghost movie recently. So, John, good to be here. Thank you for inviting us. Sound like that television programme there. Thank you for inviting us into your lovely home.
Whose house?
Yes.
Yeah. Where
did your interest in the supernatural start?
Oh, well, you can blame your mum for that. Way back when I was but a lad in the 1970s, see, I'm showing my age now.
Yeah.
She had loads and loads of paperback books on ghosts, and they had really lurid covers, gothic ladies, women in white, giant spiders, and I was really intrigued. So when she wasn't around, I'd read them, because she'd probably turn around and say, oh, you have nightmares, but I never did get any nightmares. And it just fascinated me, the stories therein. And it was also one of true ghost stories, because most of them were fictional, but there's one by a chap called Elliot O'Donnell, and he was an Irish writer, and I just read him. I couldn't believe, you know, what he experienced. He saw all these weird creatures and ghostly ladies and phantom monks, and it just hooked me, and I've literally been fascinated in ghosts ever since. And there was also a series back in 1977, Leap in the Dark, I think it was, and Colin Wilson was involved in it, and I watched that as well, and that intrigued me. So basically, yeah, a bit of Colin Wilson and my mum got me interested in ghosts. It's never left me.
Well, it was years later.
And you write about them now.
I do, yeah.
Mainly articles, is that?
Yes, I've had books published on the Romans, Oliver Cromwell and Victorian murders, but I write for Psychic News, which is a magazine which has been going since the 1930s, and it's sold all over the world. And I've been writing for about 4 years now, I think it is. And I just sort of cover sort of famous hauntings. I've written about Bawley Rectory, a church in London, Garlick Hill, and there was a mummy there.
Oh, yes.
And
Jimmy Garlick.
Oh, you've heard of him too.
Yes.
I'm impressed. Yeah, I've been there. I never saw him, though.
No,
but he put him in a coffin now.
So. Yes, he's no longer on display. You can't see it.
Because the church authorities felt that it was inappropriate to have a body on display and bring in the wrong sort of people like me, no doubt.
And me.
Yeah. And I've done articles in the Tower of London, Scottish Castles, the Black Cat of Killarcree was another one. So loads of different stuff, even a werewolf in Wales. Mm-hmm. So I sort of cover loads of things, shall we say.
Yeah. And you are now producer of an upcoming movie called
Winifred Meeks.
Winifred Meeks. And it's a ghost story.
It is.
And it's set in this part of the world.
It is, on the Suffolk coast. Originally, it was going to be set in Ireland, but the director and writer of the film, Jason Figgis, decided to move it here after we connected. And he fell in love with the East Anglian countryside anyway, because he was doing a documentary about M.R. James.
Right.
And he just thought, no, I'm going to change it from Ireland to East Anglia. And that's good, because M.R. James was an East Anglian lad, and the film is inspired by him partly.
And I mean, there is so much. You say M.R. James and you immediately think about East Anglia and countryside and the environment and the old houses you see buried in a little copse somewhere, and the coast and the beaches and things.
Well, it's supposed to be one of the most haunted places in the UK. I mean, the UK as a whole is supposed to be the most haunted country in the world anyway. But East Anglia, there's so many ghost stories connected with this part of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, virtually every town and village has a ghost story. I mean, this is haunted for a start, where we are now, and Saxmundham's got loads of ghosts, poltergeists, a Victorian gentleman's been seen walking up and down the high street. I've never seen him, but there's something about this area. You've got Black Shuck as well, the phantom dog which people believe the Vikings brought in, you know, the Hound of Odin, and that's been seen by people. I actually worked with a chap who saw it. He was driving back from work in Ipswich and going down his country lane. I think he lives at Kelsale, and he saw this creature in the lane, and it was the size of a small donkey. And he thought, God, you know, a donkey's got out. And when he got close, it was a dog.
Yeah.
And he couldn't believe how large it was. It was jet black, and it just sort of disappeared in front of him. And I did say, you know, within a year, something bad's supposed to be happening, you know, if you see it. But nothing did.
Yeah.
So, but then again, 2 years later, his shop did close down, so perhaps Black Shuck got it wrong.
Delayed. Yes. That is the most, that's the classic description of it, that it's the size of a small pony.
Yeah.
That it's been described as.
Well, I did a ghost hunt at Leyston Abbey for Felix Doe TV, because I did a few things there. I was a director and scriptwriter for a time. And we did this thing in summer. We did these ghost hunts during the daylight, so we didn't want to sort of follow other shows and do it in the dark. And we finished filming, and I was looking around at some other stuff, and then the two fellow presenters said, "Oh, God, what was that?" And I said, "What did you see?" "Well, we saw this black shape, and it shot through a wall." And it's about the size of a normal-sized dog. But later on, when they did excavations there, they found the skeleton of a dog.
Yes, big one.
Yeah,
big,
I know.
A big hunting dog, which, yes.
And I was a bit annoyed I never saw it, but nothing happened to him in a year. So there you go. So, and I did actually check later, because I wasn't aware of this. I did some research, and it was dating back to the 1930s, claims that people had seen a black dog running through the Abbey ruins. So, and they didn't know that, and I didn't know that. So I don't doubt that they saw something. But it was literally just like a black shape, about the size of a sort of normal-sized dog. But it could have been, you know, it didn't have to be a dog, but it was funny that they saw it in the area where the skeleton was later found.
Yes. Yeah. No. So tell us a bit more about the movie.
Right, well, it's a ghost story, as we said, set on the East Anglian coast, and it's heavily inspired by M.R. James, and also the film The Haunting from the 1960s, and The Legend of Hell House as well, that one. I don't know if you've ever seen that. And it's more a sort of psychological thriller as well. It's not sort of blood and guts, because we're not into that sort of type of horror. And basically, it's about a female writer, and she's having problems with her boyfriend, and she needs to get away because she's got a deadline for a book. And she goes to stay in his house in Dunwich, and things start to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's haunted by another alpha female, and she doesn't want her there. So they clash. And various... I won't give away too much plot, because obviously you've got to go and see the film.
Yes.
But things happen, and she appears, and there's conflict between the pair of them, and it's going to be a great ending. There's a cellar involved, a haunted attic, things like that. And Julie Abbott, who's with us now, plays Winifred Meeks.
You play the ghost.
I play the ghost, which is wonderful, because I've never done any acting before.
Yeah.
But my original role in this film was as the locations manager.
Yeah.
And an Irish lady was going to be playing the ghost, but she dropped out. So John said, obviously Jason, the director, asked if I'd like to play the ghost. And so here I am. So you know, I'm new to all this, but it's been really exciting.
And did you actually have any lines as a ghost?
I don't actually in this film. No, I'm just a presence.
I just wondered, because
I know, which I'm glad about, actually.
Usually they are silent, but I just wondered.
Yeah, so, you know, but I'm just a presence, and I just look very sort of menacing, really. And I've seen clips, and I'm even scared myself, to be honest. When I'm alone in my cottage, I think, oh, God, I hope Winifred Meeks isn't at the bottom of the stairs.
There is a little bit in the film, though, where you recite a prayer.
I recite a prayer, don't I?
Yes, there is that,
so...
But, and I played a husband of Winifred Meeks, but that's a flashback sequence of a photograph, isn't it, and that, but...
It is, and there's also another character that I play. It's a scene, well, Anna is watching television, isn't she?
Yeah.
And so you hear... I don't want to give too much away, really, but I have to do a Cockney accent, which I've been practising, haven't I? So I've still got that to record, so the young girl for this scene. So I've got quite a few roles in the film, haven't I?
You have.
Theme tune as well.
I had a cheese and onion roll with
an old Northumbrian folk tune that I sing. We recorded late last year, so got quite a lot of involvement in the film, really, which is wonderful.
Yeah, you know. Are you musical?
I am. Yeah, I sing and I play keyboard, but in this I just sing the song. And I used to play in a band, so I'm used to performing, but I've not done any acting before. So it's quite funny when people come up to me and talk about the film and they say, "Oh, did you go to RADA then?" No, I've not done any acting before, so I do feel really privileged. You know, because a lot of people would give anything for a role like this, wouldn't they? You know. So I'm really, really thrilled to be involved.
She's second on the bill. I'm only
second
third.
On the bill.
Terrible, isn't it?
Yeah, get to meet all these wonderful people too. So it is really exciting.
The film is really, it's very female-centred. And it's Laura Belmont who plays the writer, and obviously Julie as a ghost. I just turn up at the start, and at the end I'm the landlord. So it's as I said before, two alpha females battling for possession of the house. So, you know, it's a really strong character Winifred meets, and obviously Laura's character as well as the writer is really good. And it's just had such a great dynamic on screen. And Jason, the writer and director, you know, he really, you know, brought the best out of both of them.
Yeah.
You know,
it's Beauty and the Beast, really, isn't it?
It is, if you see her in a makeup.
Yeah, I don't really look that bad. I was in makeup, and Jo Huff, our makeup artist, did a tremendous job, didn't she?
She did.
Yeah. So that was interesting too, you know. I've never sort of sat there and had makeup applied before. I had to spray all this sort of white foundation on to make me look really pale and gaunt, and, you know, made me look hollowed out my cheeks and everything. When I looked in the mirror, I just felt, I actually felt ill because I looked so deathly. And there was a funny story, because it was actually on Halloween, wasn't it? And we were walking down the street in Dunwich, and Jason John said, well, just walk ahead of us and we'll just see if, you know, we get any reaction from anybody. And I was just walking along and didn't make eye contact with anybody. But when a couple walked past, they said, that is amazing, didn't they? Yeah. And we even, because we actually had to borrow a wedding dress, didn't we, for a scene, and from Snape, from the Antique Centre. And I can't believe I did this, but I walked around the shopping centre, didn't I, in Snape, and with all my makeup on, and the looks I was getting from people, and they looked concerned, didn't they? One girl, she kept following me around the shop, like, I wonder if she's all right, perhaps she should get to hospital. Because I did look, why did I do that?
I felt sorry for the poor girl.
I don't know why I didn't just sit in the car, but I think I forgot, really, that I got all that makeup on still. But anyway, so that was all good fun, wasn't it? It was Halloween, so, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And where is the movie now in terms of production? Pre-production, post-production.
Well, it's being edited as we speak, and Jason's coming back hopefully in March, and we're going to do some dubbing in Felixstowe at the Mark Boucher Studio. So when that's done, then the final edit will be completed, and then we're looking for a premiere. There's going to be one in Ireland, probably one in London, and then we're looking for distribution and DVD release. So we're hoping, touch wood, to have it sort of available for release by the spring.
Yeah.
Sort of perhaps May time, April, May time.
Yeah, next year.
No, actually this year.
This year,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
So, because Jason's a pretty fast mover.
He is.
I'm
he's
very impressed.
Head, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, at the latest, probably, you know, summer, but definitely this year.
Right. Excellent. And how long will the movie be?
Probably about 90 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. So, from beginning to end, and, you know, with the music and everything thrown in, and the credits and stuff. So, yeah, about 90 minutes, I reckon.
Yeah. And, have either of you in real life had any supernatural encounters?
I've had a few, obviously, because I've gone to places doing investigations and that. And I won't bore you with all of them, but I was haunted for a time by a phantom dog. This happened in Messingham. It's true. I'd be in bed at night.
Yeah.
And I'd wake up and I'd hear a dog running up the stairs. Now, I had a dog, and he was in the other room, and he used to sleep there, and I used to go in and check, and he was fast asleep, so it wasn't him, and sometimes it used to run around the bed, and that happened a few times, and it followed me down here, and when I lived with my ex in Wickham Market, it happened there as well, and then, boom, it just went. It hasn't happened for years. Probably talking about it, bringing it back, but so there was that. So literally, it used to run up the stairs, come run around the bed, and that was it. I never saw it, but it was definitely a dog, and a large dog as well, and so there was that, and there was another time when I was a kid, I woke up with a start and I was pinned down on the bed by this white light and I could not move, and I remember thinking, God, you know, my parents are going to find me in the morning dead, but I wasn't scared, you know, I just sort of accepted it, and then that went. So I know some people say, oh, it could be just you're in between that state where you're fully awake and you're still asleep and you've imagined it, because they call it night terrors, but I felt I was fully awake for that. And this place is haunted. I had a duvet pulled off me twice in the night, especially being a female, and I did actually say to her out loud, and it did worry me a bit, I must admit, because I was on my own at the time, and I did say, you know, I don't mind sharing this with you, but could you not do that again? So, yeah, and And I've been to places where, you know, like I went to St. James Garlic Hive, you know, Jimmy Garlic, we talked about that earlier, and I felt I was being watched there. And I've been to a few other places where you felt a presence and things like that. But, you know, that's probably the most that I've really experienced, you know, apart from, you know, you go somewhere and think, oh, is there someone standing behind me? And there isn't.
Even in the flat, quite recently, I could smell violets.
Oh yeah,
like perfume, really strong, sickly sweet perfume. Because I said, if you spray something in here, because it smells.
Oh, it smells violets.
Yeah, it might have been your aftershave. Don't use that again. And then there was a smell of toast as well.
Yeah,
which was odd. So.
And you do often get with hauntings, you do get a smell. Sometimes that's the way they make themselves, you know, sort of a manifestation, shall we say. And you often get perfume or the smell of food. I've never experienced that, but Julie did. So.
How that works, I don't know, but definitely very strong.
Yeah.
Only just that one time.
Yeah.
But I've never actually seen a ghost, but I have had odd experiences. Quite recently, well, I went to Borley Church, and I went to a church service there one Easter Sunday, and some odd things happened which couldn't really be explained. But at the time, it's not until afterwards you think, well, that was odd, you know, you don't sort of get really frightened by it, but afterwards you think, well, how did that happen then? And I won't go into all the details, but the latch lifted by itself, and wasn't a windy day. And so after one of the hymns, the lady said, oh, I better go and shut the door. She said, that wasn't our ghost, because they don't like to talk about the ghost today. And she was like, that wasn't our ghost, you know, there's no ghost here. And there was a smell of incense and one or two odd things.
The thing is with that as well, because I've written about the haunting, that is one of the aspects of it, that the latch lifts. If you actually saw the church door, it is really heavy. The wind couldn't do that. And that's been experienced quite a few times, and again the smell of incense as well. But the locals don't like people talking about the ghost, so they sort of, oh, it's not the ghost.
Which is understandable, because they don't want people turning up at all hours, do they?
Well, you do get some people who turn up at 1 o'clock in the morning and decide to hold a seance in someone's garden, so I can imagine why they're not exactly very happy with that.
Funnily enough, my other experience was not far from there in a village called Boxford, and that was Easter too, and I was there with my daughter, and we just stood in the oak porch. It's a really, really lovely old oak porch to the church, and I felt I had a time slip brief experience, because I could hear a choir singing in the church, and I said to my daughter, I said, oh, we better not go in, there's some people in there. And she couldn't hear anything, and I felt slightly detached from everything. The car, I could still hear the traffic, but it was almost as if I was in a greenhouse and somebody shut the door. That's kind of echoey. And I just thought, oh, this is odd, can you not hear that, Kirsty? I said to my daughter, and she said no, and then it stopped, and then I opened the church door and there was nobody in there, so that was very odd. So I can't explain that, but I haven't actually seen a ghost.
No, but you've heard them.
I had experiences. I mean, people could, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, there must have been somebody in the church, but there wasn't, so I'm just open-minded, you know. Keep an open mind.
What do you think is the fascination people have for the supernatural? I mean, people have been telling ghost stories since...
Beginning of time, really.
You know, there's Roman tales of them, and Greeks have ghosts and stories. You know, it's a feature of life, well, human condition, that we have this fascination with ghosts and the supernatural. What do you think is the...
Well, I think we all have a mystical side to us, and I also believe it's... Well, everyone likes to be scared. You know, it's like going on the fairground, isn't it? There's that thrill, that adrenaline rush of being scared. But I think a lot of it is to do with fear of death as well. We all want to believe in the afterlife. We all want to believe that there's something beyond this world and that our loved ones are waiting. And I think that's another reason why people are fascinated with ghosts and that, because we want to believe that there is something. I mean, I believe there is. And that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in it, because I'm quite interested in spiritualism anyway. So I would basically say, one, it's the enjoyment of being scared, but two, people want to believe there's something after this life. Because let's face it, I mean, they do say that animals are not aware of death or anything like that. We're the only ones who are aware that, you know, you die eventually.
Yes.
And, you know, that we want to have something beyond this world, you know, because you think all these great people who existed, like Einstein and that, it'd be terrible to think that that's it, they're gone forever. Mm. It's nice to think that perhaps their spirit or soul or whatever you want to call it has lived on and is somewhere else, another plane. You can call it heaven, you can call it whatever you like. I mean, I believe, you know, there is something beyond this world. And yeah, so I think that's why it is a fascination for ghost stories. It's a combination of getting a good scare and obviously wanting to exist beyond this life.
Yeah. And completely changing the topic.
Yeah.
The Beatles.
Yeah.
What's your interest in the Beatles?
Oh, I love them. I absolutely love them. Big part of my life. Always have been, always will be. I wasn't born when the Beatles started, of course. I got into the Beatles in 1982. I was aware of John Lennon's death in 1980 and I was shocked. I was only a kid at the time. But they had the 20th anniversary of Love Me Do. Mm-hmm. And my brother was a big Beatles fan and they had all these celebrations and they re-released the record. And I started listening to the music and I thought, God, they're really good. You know, I love the personalities as well, especially John Lennon's my favourite, but they really work together. I call them lightning in a bottle. Mm. The four of them together, they had great solo careers, but the four of them together, there was just something extra. Mm-hmm. And I regard them as the greatest band in popular music. I don't think there'll ever be another Beatles, but it was the music, the humour. I mean, they influenced everything in the 60s. You know, John Lennon said they were up in a crow's nest in that boat called the 60s, you know, telling people where to go. Fashions, you know, political viewpoints, things like that. I mean, the Beatles refused to play to segregated audiences in the South, which for the time in 64 would have been shocking, but they wouldn't do it. And they're credited with breaking that prejudice. You know, if we play to people, we want to play to black people as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the way they progressed and they changed music, because in the early 60s it was a bit dowdy and boring. You had all these insipid sort of, you know, Venus was her name and all that. Yeah. And you had Cliff and he was okay, but, you know, sort of Elvis had gone into the army, you know, the old rock and rollers for whatever reason had got arrested or got religion. Mm-hmm. And they needed something, and by God the Beatles came along and kickstarted the 60s for me. Mm-hmm. And when you look at like Love Me Do, a great tune, but you think within 4 years they were doing Revolver and Tomorrow Never Knows, that progression. Mm. And then Sgt. Pepper. Mm. and they're still an influence to this day. You modern artists who say, you know, who's inspired you, they'll all say the Beatles. Mm. And that's I just love them, always I have done and always will. And it's just like the music, the personality, the fashions, everything about them. Mm. And obviously someone up there wanted them to get together. I mean, you think in a city like Liverpool, you had Lennon, McCartney, and they met.
Yeah.
All those great songs. It's a shame how they split, but, you know, no band can go on forever. And perhaps it was they were meant to split at that time, because I wouldn't have liked them to have gone on like the Stones and done too many albums that were rubbish. At least everything they did was good.
Yeah.
And they ended on a high note. You know, the last recorded album was Abbey Road. I know Let It Be came out after that. But, you know, what an album to end on, Abbey Road. And they ended with the end.
Yeah.
Apart from obviously that little jokey bit of a majesty which they left on, but yeah.
Yeah. And your other big hero is Kenny Everett.
Yes, good old Kenny. I love Kenny. And I've actually been told by more than one spiritualist that he hangs around and I channel him sometimes, which is a bit scary. But if you listen to my radio show, you said last week, didn't you? Is that Kenny talking then?
There are certain similarities.
Well, what I love about Kenny, he was such, I regard him as the greatest DJ that this country's seen, and these other DJs have said that, you know, Chris Tarrant, you know, people like that, they said, you know, he was unique. It was his humour, it was the way he did his shows, it was his, he used to take the mickey as well. I mean, he got the sack so many times of taking the mickey. Mm-hmm. And he refused to sort of kowtow to the BBC, their policy at the time, that you had to play stuff by the Northern Dance Orchestra.
Yeah.
You couldn't play exclusively pop, and he wouldn't have that. And he did all these sketches, and he had the Kenny Everett video show, which was groundbreaking for the time. I think it started in 78. It's just come out on DVD if people want to get it. And he was just a really bubbly person. personality, and all the pop stars wanted to go on his show. I mean, Freddie Mercury went on there, Sting, you know, Gary Newman, Kate Bush, they're all queuing up to be on there. And he was just a really, really funny guy. And funny enough, in private, though, he was totally opposite to the image he had on the radio and the TV. He's very quiet and shy. I met someone who met him in a gay club in London, and he went up to him and said, "Oh my God, you're Kenny Everett." And he sort of go away, I don't want to talk to you, I just want to drink. You know, but no, he's just a unique personality. And, you know, if I was half as good as him, I'd be happy on the radio. But it's such a unique personality. If you listen to his old shows on YouTube and that, God, you know, they still to this day stand out. And the trouble is with radio now, I've found a lot of commercial radio, they don't want you with personalities. Mm. I don't know if you found that being on the radio yourself. They do not want that jokiness, that quirkiness. They said, "Well, now the next tune is this, and we'll be back in 20 minutes. Mm. Have a fab time." And that's it, and that's not radio for me. I could have been on North Norfolk Radio, and the chap said, "You know, but we don't want you to do any Kenny Everett. We don't want any personality, and you can only speak for 10 minutes every hour." And I said, "I forget it." Yeah.
You are a bit like Alan Partridge.
Am I? Alan Partridge, I beg your pardon.
The things you come out with.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a bit like Alan Partridge, Schubert. Yeah. So that's my waxing lyrical about Kenny. And he's behind you as we speak.
Yes,
we're lucky.
Just point at the picture. Yes,
yeah. And he's all
right. We bumped into Eddie Puma, didn't we? Who was his
producer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he lives locally.
Yeah, he produced Kate Bush and Paul McCormick, as I say, yeah. McCartney. And he worked with Kenny, so we've got to meet up with him because he's got loads of pictures of him. So hopefully he might give me a couple.
Yeah, we hope to meet up again, aren't we?
Yeah. So that's why I love Kenny anyway. I just think he's an inspiration. And if you're a budding DJ and you're listening, listen to some of Kenny's shows.
Yeah.
Because he could teach you a thing or two, I think.
Well, I think on that note, that's a great note. John West, thank you ever so much.
Thanks very
brilliant.
Much. Been a pleasure.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, part of the Paranormal UK radio network.
Let's have some diary dates. We've had a story already about witchcraft. So here's good news for all fans of Wicca and witchcraft. We all, as Witchfest International has just announced it's returning to its traditional UK home of the Fairfield Halls in Croydon, and will be coming there again on the 9th of November this year, 2019. The official announcement goes on to say that with a freshly refurnished building and additional space available, it will be bigger and better than ever before. Witchfest and Fairfield have a long history, so we hope you are as pleased with the move as we are. We'll miss Brighton, which is where Witchfest has been for the last few years. It'll always be our second home, but we're looking forward to being back in Croydon, and we've already started booking speakers and entertainers. Speakers booked already include Professor Ronald Hutton, who needs no introduction to anybody interested in paganism and the history of witchcraft. Maxine Saunders, one of the leading lights of the witchcraft movement in the 1960s and 1970s. Plus Pete Jennings and Rachel Patterson. Bands that have been booked include the Dolmen, Damn the Bard, that's with an H on the end, not an N, and the Medieval Babes. For more details, check out www.witchfest.net/events. And going even further ahead to next February, when it is the next celebration of Imolc, or Imbolc, if you like to pronounce the B in it. This is the early spring fire festival. And here's an interesting one. Out in the village of Marsden, which is on the A62 between Manchester and Huddersfield out on Saddlemouth Moor. They have now started running a two-yearly end-of-winter festival. And the next occurrence of that festival, which, looking at pictures from last year's one, involves lots of people in hoods and rather frightening masks marching around, fireworks, bonfires and the like. The next date for that is it'll be the 1st of February 2020. It's almost like a version of The Wicker Man, except for nobody gets burned in a large wicker man. So, fans of Imolc, check out Marsden, West Yorkshire, 1st of February next year. I recently had the pleasure of being interviewed by the Russian TV channel REN TV on a topic of folklore and urban legends. And the topics we discussed, Bonnie and Clyde and the supposedly fairy tale of Bluebeard. The woman on the other end is Olga from Moscow. Which sounds a bit implausible, but no, that was her name. And after that, we go on to talk about Bluebeard. However, the interview there covers a lot of topics that doesn't quite lend itself for this show. So instead, I'll be talking about the background to Bluebeard, his origins, and some historical characters who may have actually been the inspiration in a little separate piece. I know you're thinking to yourselves, that's what the Russians are interested in? American gangsters and European serial killers?
Okay, so who is Bluebeard?
First published by, written by Charles Perrault and published in 1697, so it's quite an ancient story. Now, essentially Bluebeard, a rather ugly man with a large bushy beard, but he was wealthy, he was a member of the aristocracy, so had blue blood, hence the term Bluebeard, as opposed to some kind of dyeing effect on his beard. Bluebeard was a powerful nobleman who'd been married several times to beautiful women who'd all mysteriously vanished. And so it came that he married his next young bride, and shortly after they were married, he gave her the keys of his chateau and said she is able to open any of the doors in the house with them, each of which contains some of his riches, except for an underground chamber, which he strictly forbids her to enter, lest she suffers his wrath. Although he has given her the keys, including the key to the mystery chamber. You'll not be surprised to know that after he goes on a journey and leaving the house and the keys in her hands, she invites her sister Anne and some friends over for a party, but eventually is overcome with desire to see what the forbidden room holds, so sneaks away from the party and ventures into the room. She opens the door and discovers it's full of blood, and there hanging on the walls are the murdered corpses of all Bluebeard's former wives, hanging up on hooks on the wall. Horrified, as she would be, she drops the key into the blood on the floor and rushes away, and then remembers she's left the key there and the door open, so she goes back and retrieves the key, locks the door, but she can't wash the blood from the key. It's a magical key, of course. She tells the awful secret to her sister, and they both decide that they'll flee the next morning. Yeah, they're old. Oh, we'll sleep on it and leave the next morning. What could possibly go wrong? Except, of course, first thing in the morning, Bluebeard unexpectedly returns and finds the bloody key. In a blind rage, he threatens to kill her on the spot. And she asks for one last prayer with her sister. But at the very last moment, very conveniently, the brothers of the wife and her sister Anne arrive and they kill Bluebeard. So the wife inherits his fortune, has all the dead wives decently buried. We've mentioned this before. It's quite a big thing in medieval and early modern times that people get a proper burial. And she uses her fortune to help her family get married, marries a man she loves, and generally moves on with her life. Now, Needless to say, there are Freudian implications in the story. There are always Freudian implications in fairy tales. The blood and the key having sexual connotations. Key, man, unlucking a woman, etc. But there is also another element to this story, and that it's not really a horror story about a serial killer. No, you'll be surprised to know. It's actually a cautionary tale for young married women that basically says, do what your husband tells you, dear, or something really horrible might happen to you. I know, it's a modern air world. No one get away with that nowadays. But, you know, we are talking about events that happened 300 plus years ago. So can't really judge the morals of the story by our modern standards. But another question is, where did the story of Bluebeard come from? What was the model for it? Who dreamt up the idea? One of the most popular suggestions is it was that the model for Bluebeard, the inspiration, was a French nobleman of the early 15th century. He lived circa AD 1405 to 1440, called Gilles de Rais. He was a baron. He was a leader of the French army. He was a companion of Joan of Arc, and he led the French in many successful battles against the English. However, sometime after the death of Joan of Arc, he appears to, with hindsight, probably had a nervous breakdown or a midlife crisis. We first hear of him squandering a huge amount of his money on a play he put on. It had 140 speaking parts and 500 extras. It was actually based on the Siege of New Orleans, so it was a fairly epic story. And as I say, he nearly bankrupted himself, not least because there were over 600 costumes that had to be manufactured, and unlimited supplies of food and drink were made available both to the cast and the spectators. Shortly after that, he seems to have got involved in the occult, and he contacted the services of a couple of priests, one called Eustache Blanchet and the other one François Prelati, and they apparently knew all about alchemy and demon summoning, and they also had some magical books, grimoires, and Gilles de Rais tried a number of experiments in his dungeons at his castle to try and summon up a demon. But in fact, no demon manifested itself, but he did end up spending quite a lot of money on it. The end of his story comes when he is accused of being a serial killer. In fact, he confessed everything without even resorting to torture. And basically, he preyed on children and young boys and young men. Their age was between 6 and 18. Say mainly boys. He sexually abused them and then murdered them, and in some instances hacked their bodies to pieces and generally gloated and reveled in the blood and gore. Their bodies were then burned. Depending on who you believe, he was responsible for between 80 and 200 murders, although some people say it was as much as 600. Anyway, he confessed, and in the year 1440, on the 26th of October, he was executed. For those who like the gory details, he was hanged and then burned, although in his case he was only burned a little bit, and four ladies of rank, they described, claimed the charred body and took it off for burial. His henchmen, who were also involved, they were just left to burn to ashes and scatter to the four winds. So, thoroughly unpleasant person. But did he do it? Ever since, there's been quite a lot of controversy. One element is this was during a period where the Kingdom of France was trying to consolidate its borders and was in a dispute over the Duchy of Brittany. And Gilles de Rais was a leading noble from Brittany. So there is a suggestion that framing him for the murders may be a good way of getting him out of the way so all his territories could be seized by the French crown. And of course, yes, he confessed to the crimes, but as we know, people still to this day confess committing crimes that they didn't do and suffer the consequences of it. So as I say, it does look as if somewhere along in his early middle age, the poor man had a nervous breakdown or some sort of mental relapse into mental illness. But there's even more theories about it. As both Margaret Murray, who is best known nowadays for the book The Witch Cult in Western Europe, and Aleister Crowley, who anybody listening to this show should need no introduction to, they say he was the male equivalent of Joan of Arc. His only crime was the pursuit of knowledge. Margaret Murray goes on to say he was a martyr to a pre-Christian pagan religion, and it was all a big stitch-up. He wasn't a lapsed Catholic who descended into crime and depravity. He was framed for his views. So a bit of a mystery over Gilles de Rais, but it does also raise a question of, well, there's nothing really in his story that links with Bluebeard, because the bodies weren't discovered in Gilles de Rais' castle. They weren't his brides. They weren't women. And Bluebeard actually married his victims and then murdered them. Whereas if we accept that Gilles de Rais was a serial killer, he just did horrible things to his victims and killed them. So they're probably not. However, there's another suggestion that he may have actually been connected with the story of an early Breton, though we're talking Brittany again, a king called Conamor the Accursed. And he was a historical character who lived sometime in the late Roman period, what we nowadays call, well, we used to call the Dark Ages, sometime in the 5th or 6th century, so in 500 AD onwards. He married a lady called Tryphine, French name, and she was warned by the ghosts of his previous wives that he murders them when they become pregnant, which was rather bad news for the new Tryphine because she was pregnant. And so she fled for her life, but unfortunately Conmar, the accursed, caught her and beheaded her. Whereupon a saint came along called St. Gildas, who miraculously restored her to life. He then causes Conmar to approach the wall of his castle, which falls upon him and kills him. He's also meant to have killed Saint Tryphine's son, another saint called Saint Trimur. But here's an interesting little twist in it, because King Conmar is also identified with King Mark, who is one of the characters in the Arthurian legends. He is Sir Tristan's uncle. He is a bit of a villain. It's said that he had horse's ears and had long hair which covered them, and the only people who knew his secrets, his secret of his ears, were his barbers who cut his hair and looked after his hair. And they unfortunately only got the gig once because he murdered them, so they would never reveal his secret. And I say, in the Arthurian legends, and there's a number of versions of it, he rather foolishly sends young Tristan off to collect a beautiful woman who is to be his wife. Her name is Isolde. Sadly, due to a bit of a mix-up with some magic potion, which often happens in medieval legends, Tristan falls in love with Isolde, and he ends up having an affair with her after she's married King Mark. King Mark's not very happy about this, so depending on the version, he either kills Tristan and Isolde, or they escape and live happily ever after. So there we go, very quickly from the fairy tale of Bluebeard to one of the characters in King Arthur by way of French serial killers and a possible very early Breton serial killer called King Codamore, who may have also been King Mark of Cornwall.
So, Bonnie and Clyde, very shortly, your ideas. Why did this story become so popular? Because it wasn't really a romantic story, but it was made by journalists and writers and so on. So, what's your idea? Why it became so popular?
Well, I suppose one element is the fact that during their criminal career, Bonnie, the woman, did engage with the media and, didn't have social media, but she was sending poems and pictures and stories to the newspapers, and it struck a nerve with people at the time. This was the time of the Great Depression in America, when banks were going bust, farmers were being thrown off their land, there was huge droughts, and the people of the time thought, the system's against them. Here's somebody who's standing up against it. And then, more recently, there was the movie made in 1967, and that gave it a huge boost. That was a huge cult movie. Again, it coincided with the era of the 1960s and counterculture revolution, and the Vietnam War was going on in America. And again, this is people standing up against an authoritarian, uncaring society and fighting for their own turf. So I think it's, that movie was 50 years ago, which is longer than the time between when Bonnie and Clyde were actually active and the movie was made, it's kept it alive. So when people think of gangsters, the most famous one is Al Capone, because so many stories were told about him. But then Bonnie and Clyde come up there as this sort of romantic anti-heroes, and we tend to gloss over the fact that they killed people, that they were seen as the small people fighting against a big uncaring society that was against them.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Well, that's it. Almost time for us to go. But before we do, as ever, I'm going to squeeze in one last story. And it's about a place called the Swan Inn at Sybil Headingham, in the village of Sybil Headingham in Essex. And it's the Swan Inn is located near a stream. And it's the scene of the last recorded instance of the swimming of a suspected witch. The concept of swimming was that you would throw a witch into the water, water being the element of baptism, which would reject a witch. Guilt was considered to be proved if the suspect floated, and innocent if the suspect sank, which is a little unfortunate because that usually meant they drowned, so they were going to be hanged if they floated and they were going to be drowned if they didn't float. Anyway, what's surprising about this is that the last swimming was in 1863. Yes. Only 150 years ago, when an 80-year-old deaf-mute, nicknamed Old Dummy, people were not very politically correct in those days, was accused by Mrs. Smith of casting a spell which had made her ill. Villagers dragged the old man, who'd been enjoying a beer in the bar of the Swan, and threw him in the stream. And there he was left to his fate. He struggled in the water as villagers threw stones at him. But eventually some villagers took pity on him and hauled him out. He died several days later in the local workhouse. Meanwhile, Mrs. Smith and a man named Stammers were charged with manslaughter, largely on the evidence of a young child. Both were found guilty and given sentences in 1864 of 6 months hard labour. Doesn't sound a lot, but hard labour was hard labour in those days. Swimming, eh? Right, well, thank you very much for listening. We hope you'll join us again next time. But until then, stay well, stay weird, stay different. Good night.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon, which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your fortnightly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic and folklore on the Paranormal UK radio network. Join us again in 2 weeks' time for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Good night.